could be you, but it's too late. Sister, can you hear me? Better break your date. Stop it right now. Could be you, but it's too late. Sister, can you hear me? Better break your date. Stop it right now. It's already too late. Sister, sister. Typewriters, ass biters, big jivers, hang nails, big ties, nosy eyes, lots of lies, cramps, shit taking, head aching, fire baking, brain shaking. I ain't taking anymore. Talk to Alice, she may understand. No trust, big bust. I wonder if the new girl lives alone. Man's eyes fantasize. Jody wants to tell the boss to get off. Elevators, see you later. Tell all the girls noon in the lunchroom. And maybe
this is from Sheila Levine, is alive and is dead, sorry, and living in New York. Sheila, darling, listen to your mother. Teaching is always something you can fall back on. The Monday after I graduated, the ink on my diploma not yet dry, I went out into the world to seek my fortune. With the New York Times under my arm, I got my job through the New York Times. I headed for Manhattan on the Long Island Railroad. Tap, tap, tap. Sheila, darling, I don't know why you want to knock yourself out looking for a job when you can teach, be home at 3, get Christmas vacation, the whole summer off, good starting salary. Mrs. Lichten's Cynthia has been teaching for 2 years, loves it. Went to Europe last summer and Puerto Rico over Easter. Mother, I don't want to teach. I want to do something creative. Creative? Excuse me, college graduate. Excuse me for even suggesting something that isn't creative. I wanted the type of job that Glamour magazine writes about. Women who are doing things. Sally Harding spends most of her day in a helicopter with her handsome boss, whom she married just 6 days after becoming his creative assistant. The picture shows Sally, blonde, thin, straight hair with a little flip on the end, in a white coat, getting into a helicopter beside her big, handsome husband boss. They are off to buy two of the world's most expensive paintings, and Mr. Harding wouldn't think of going without little Sally. Did she get her job through the New York Times? Did Sally's mother nudge her to teach? As a result of an ad in the Times, the first employment agency I went to was called For College Graduates Only, one flight up on West 45th. Why did I think they were waiting for me? Come right this way, Sheila. Here's your creative job, and right over there, through that door, are the reporter and photographer from Glamour, waiting to get your fascinating story. No, they weren't waiting for Sheila. As a matter of fact, they did their best to avoid her. In the reception area, dirty beige walls, dirty beige floor, dirty beige chairs, were 8 Sheilas and about 5 young Mannies, all with the New York Times classified section under their arms, ads circled in pencil. All the girls in black sheaths, all the boys in blue cord jackets, the whole group carrying trench coats. And where was Doris Day? How come she came to New York, got off the train, some man spilled coffee on her, made her head of his advertising company, lent her his handkerchief when she cried, and then married her? Is there such a big difference between Sheila Levine and Doris Day? Yes. Doris Day goes to funerals to see people buried, and Sheila Levine goes to funerals to get buried. The receptionist at the For College Graduates Only agency gave everybody a card to fill out. I shouldn't have been a mommy. I should have been a mommy. If I had been a mommy, I wouldn't have had to fill out that card. Sheila, darling, if you had gone into teaching, then you wouldn't have had to fill out that card. Tap, tap, tap all you want on my casket, Mother. I can't hear you now. With a ballpoint pen leaning on my patent leather pocketbook, Social Security 13330-6165, name Sheila Lynn Levine. Last job held, none. Reason for leaving last job? Should I leave it blank? If I didn't have a last job, I couldn't have a reason for leaving it. I squeezed in, I never worked, then crossed that out. Card looked messy. Should I ask for another? Would the receptionist think I was stupid? How do people who work in employment agencies get their jobs? Ever think about that? Turn the card over. Skills. Should I put that I type a little? If I do, then maybe they'll send me to a job that requires some typing, and I don't want to type. I want to go buy paintings and helicopters. Skills, none. Card looking terrific. Boy, would I hire this Sheila Levine. Never worked, can't do anything, makes messes. Question. What type of work are you looking for? Aha! I am looking for anything creative. Last question. Education. Aha! College graduate, you dumb blanks. I sat and waited for my turn to be interviewed, staring at the walls, avoiding eye contact with anyone, hoping none of the other girls landed the job of the year before it was my turn. There was a man interviewer and a woman interviewer. I hoped and prayed for the man. I don't relate to women, never did. The only D I ever got in college was from a woman teacher to whom I didn't relate. Next, my turn. It was the woman. Come on, Sheila, relate. Don't get another D. The woman motioned for me to follow her to her office. Not actually an office, one of those make-believe offices, a partitioned cubicle. She gestured for me to sit, and I sat. I'm Sheila Levine. I read your ad in the classified section, taking out paper, making a mess of paper all over this lady's desk. She wasn't looking at me. She was looking at my card. I bet that card really wowed her. Ah, yes, here it is. Bright gal, col grad, good pay. For college grads only agency, 555-7826, 44 West 45. You see, it's right here. She didn't look up. She wouldn't look up and face me. Miss Burke was the name of this charming woman. Miss Burke, whom did you think you were fooling? Your name used to be Berkowitz, and when you graduated from college, your parents offered you a nose job or a fur coat, and you took the nose job, didn't you? We all know that's what you did. Do you know, Miss Burke, how many people said, "That's a nose job if I've ever seen one," behind your back? Silly, Miss Burke, you should have worn the nose of your heritage proudly, like Barbara Streisand and Sheila Levine. Miss Burke made me sit in her cubicle, small, sloppy, with nebbish ashtrays, unfunny signs on the wall, like "Plan Ahead," a big poster of Mona Lisa winking. She probably had a pencil holder in the shape of a penis in her top drawer. She made me sit there for about 10 minutes without looking at me. Maybe I had her old nose. Finally she spoke. The speaking gave her away for the Berkowitz she really was. With her dress from Henri Bendel and her 10 rings from Saks, her voice still said East Flatbush. "Miss Burke, let me give you a piece of advice. Hawk the rings and take speech lessons." "Do you type?" "Actually, I don't really want a job where I have to type. I want to do something creative. I'm here to answer your ad in the paper, the one where they were looking for a bright gal." "That's me, a bright gal, ha-ha." To this day, I wish I could take back those ha-has. "May I see that paper, miss?" "Certainly, certainly. See, here's the ad, bright gal, ha-ha-ha." She took the paper from me, and in her alligator pumps, which I'm sure she wouldn't have worn had she known the alligator was becoming extinct, walked out of the room. Walking lessons she also had. "I'm telling you, Miss Burke, get rid of the voice, you could land in Onassis." She was back in a flash, didn't even give me a chance to read anything upside down on her desk. "I'm sorry, that job has been taken." "Was it a good job?" Big Mouth had to know. "What's the difference? It's been taken." "I was just curious. I mean, it's nice to know that somebody got a nice job. I mean, it's nice to know that there are nice jobs available. I mean, do you type?" "I type a little, but I don't want a job where I have to type. I want to do some creative type of work. I wouldn't even consider a job that required typing." "How many words a minute?" 29, but I don't want..." "Not too good. Shorthand?" I should have said, "No, Miss Burke, and I feel this interview has come to an end. You and your people obviously don't understand what I'm looking for. Good day, Miss Burke. Next time, get your voice fixed." I said, "No," with my eyes on my chipped nail polish. "Well, let's see if we have anything." She started riffling through the cards on her desk, removing a paperweight of somebody sitting on the toilet. Charming, absolutely charming. The phone rang. She picked it up immediately. "Hello, Burke here." She got out a new 3x5 card on which she wrote down information with a pen that had an 8-ball on the end of it. "Yes, your name, the name of the firm, job requirements, typing, shorthand, preference to age, color, religion. Miss Burke, I hope you're not still doing that. Do you read the papers? You're not allowed to do that anymore. You wouldn't want to have to go to jail and eat bread and water and give up your charge accounts, would you?" "How much does the job pay?" she asked. "You're kidding. I don't know if I can get anybody to work for such coolie wages." She hung up the phone, turned to me with the new 3x5 card in her hand, and said, without shame, "A job just came in you might be right for. Do you have to type?" "Yes, your typing isn't good enough, but we'll lie a little. You go to 418 West 39th, room 1411, and ask for a Mr. Mann. Call me after the interview. The fee is 1 week's salary, due the day employment starts." She handed me the address on a slip of paper, and I walked out of the office in a daze, right through another crop of young hopefuls with their classified sections. God damn it. Doris Day never typed. And this is from a novel that I am not going to identify at the moment. When I made my wan entrance into the office at about 10 o'clock, J.C. stood up and came around to her desk to shut the door, and I sat in the swivel chair in front of my typewriter table facing her, and she sat in the swivel chair behind her desk facing me, with the window full of potted plants, shelf after shelf of them, springing up at her back like a tropical garden. "Doesn't your work interest you, Esther?" "Oh, yes, it does," I said. "It interests me very much." I felt like yelling the words as if that might make them more convincing, but I controlled myself. All my life I'd told myself studying and reading and writing and working like mad was what I wanted to do, and it actually seemed to be true. I did everything well enough and got all A's, and by the time I made it to college, nobody could stop me. I was college correspondent for the Town Gazette, and editor of the literary magazine and secretary of honor board, which deals with academic and social offenses and punishments, a popular office, and I had a well-known woman poet and professor on the faculty championing me for graduate school at the biggest universities in the East, and promises of full scholarships all the way. And now I was apprenticed to the best editor on an intellectual fashion magazine. And what did I do but balk and balk like a dull cart horse? I'm very interested in everything. The words fell with a hollow flatness onto JC's desk like so many wooden nickels. I'm glad of that, JC said a bit waspishly. You can learn a lot in this month on the magazine, you know, if you just roll up your shirt sleeves. The girl who was here before you didn't bother with any of the fashion show stuff. She went straight from this office on to Time. My, I said in the same sepulchral tone. That was quick. Of course, you have another year at college yet, JC went on a little more mildly. What do you have in mind after you graduate? What I always thought I had in mind was getting some big scholarship to graduate school or a grant to study all over Europe. And then I thought I'd be a professor and write books of poems, or write books of poems and be an editor of some sort. Usually I had these plans on the tip of my tongue. I don't really know, I heard myself say. I felt a deep shock hearing myself say that, because the minute I said it, I knew it was true. It sounded true, and I recognized it, the way you recognize some nondescript person that's been hanging around your door for ages, and then suddenly comes up and introduces himself as your real father, and looks exactly like you. So you know he really is your father, and the person you thought all your life was your father is a sham. I don't really know. You'll never get anywhere like that, JC paused. What languages do you have? Oh, I can read a bit of French, I guess, and I've always wanted to learn German. I'd been telling people I'd always wanted to learn German for about 5 years. What I didn't say was that each time I picked up a German dictionary or a German book, the very sight of those dense, blacked, barbed wire letters made my mind shut like a clam. I've always thought I'd like to go into publishing. I tried to recover a thread that might lead me back to my old bright salesmanship. I guess what I'll do is apply at some publishing house. You ought to read French and German, JC said mercilessly, and probably several other languages as well. Spanish and Italian, better still, Russian. Hundreds of girls flood into New York every June thinking they'll be editors. You need to offer something more than the run-of-the-mill person. You better learn some languages. I hadn't the heart to tell JC there wasn't one scrap of space in my senior year schedule to learn languages in. I was taking one of those honors programs that teach you to think independently, and except for a course in Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and a seminar in advanced poetry composition, I would spend my whole time writing some obscure theme in the works of James Joyce. I hadn't picked out my theme yet because I hadn't got round to reading Finnegan's Wake, but my professor was very excited about my thesis and had promised to give me some leads on images about twins. I'll see what I can do, I told JC. I probably might just fit in one of those double-barreled accelerated courses in elementary German they've rigged up. I thought at the time I might actually do this. I had a way of persuading my class dean to let me do irregular things. She regarded me as a sort of interesting experiment. This last one is something else I'm also not going to identify right now. Many of you probably will know what it is. This is also fiction. I set out among the subways, the red and white Coke machines and ads for Dr. Scholl's foot powder to find another job. Night work ran in two categories, telephone operating or various forms of entertainment. Since Hal Prince did not rush out on the street to sign me up, I found myself dancing nightly in a bar in the West 50s. That lasted 2 weeks, until I provided a dentist with a patient needing a new set of uppers. There was nothing to do but change my schedule, cut down on classes, and work during the day. I got a job as a secretary at Silver Publishing Company. Every morning at 9 a.m., I roared into the office in complete female rig, skirt, stockings, slips. I couldn't cross my legs because some of the more obvious sperm producers would try to look up my leg. Couldn't put my feet on the desk because that wasn't ladylike. And if I didn't wear makeup, everyone, including the boss, would ask me if I was under the weather that day. My immediate superior was Stella by Starlight. Stella had married the president of the company, David Cohen, so she worked, just for fun. Stella looked exactly like Ruby Keeler, and someone must have told her this back in 1933 because she had been trying ever since to be a carbon copy of the original. At the merest suggestion of Ruby, she'd go into the routine from Footlight Parade. Then her husband, aroused by the sound of tapping feet, would have to come out of his office to remind her there were galleys to be read, and would she save the dance until after 5? We lowlies were herded into the bullpen, where we cheerlessly typed up anything from a bill to the latest manuscript, as well as churning out back copy, front copy, and captions for bent photographs. In a short time, Stella managed to notice that I could both read and spell, 2 points in my favor, joined by a remarkable third. I could dash off copy on command. Stella rescued me from the bullpen and threw me in with one of the prized editors, James Adler. Maria Radden, another groundling who had fought her way up to being head receptionist, unfortunately had a full-blown heterosexual crush on James. She'd practically slide into the office on her own lubrication and croon at him, "James, may I fetch you some coffee, anything at all this morning?" James abhorred her and gave her a curt no on these persistent occasions. Rhea exhibited the peculiar twists so often found in the brains of straight women. She became convinced that James treated her brusquely because he and I were having a hot fling. She decided to make life miserable for me. Any work she got from my hands, she deliberately botched and then blamed it on me. Once a week, she would slip into Mr. Cohen's office with another horrendous mistake she had saved the printer from committing because of my laxity and poor work habits. James, in an heroic effort to save me, reported his perceptions of the situation to Mr. Cohen, who couldn't believe anyone, even Rhea, could be so stupid. A bad case of the hots was only one of Rhea's faults. She was notoriously lazy and connived to get other luckless lowlies to do her job for her, thereby giving her time to file her fingernails and change the color of the polish daily. Mr. Cohen turned a blind eye to her eternal manicure by saying we should be kind to her. After all, her mother did kill herself when Rhea was 11. The situation grew daily more intolerable, and the mixture of loneliness since Holly left and the irritation at work gave birth to a scheme I was sure would do old Rhea Ratface in. Sunday night, I went out with a plastic garbage bag and collected every agreeable specimen of dog droppings I could find. I got half a bag full, and I carefully twisted the candy-striped red wire and put it next to my briefcase for tomorrow's labor. 7 in the morning, I was dragging that damn bag through the subway station, up the stairs, and into the square office building streaked with grime, pigeon patties, and car exhaust. By 8, I had feverishly crammed the presents into Rhea's desk drawers. Then I evacuated by the back stairway and didn't come back until 9:10. Rhea was at her desk, Revlon's mocha mist by her right hand, the telephone in her left, chattering away as usual. Mr. Cohen came in with Sheila trailing after him at 9:20. Rhea was still on the phone. James and I were working on a book about medieval art when Rhea paraded through the open door. "Really, James, I don't see why you and Miss Bolt have to sit so close together when you can work. Photographs of Flemish churches can't be that interesting." "Rhea, don't you have some work to do?" James muttered. "Yes, I was taking a little break. Would you like some coffee?" "No, thank you." She oozed away, thoroughly happy that she had needled her love. Through the open door, I could see her plopped at her desk behind the glass partition on the phone again. She hadn't cracked a desk drawer. The entire morning crept along, and she never opened even one drawer. James and I were having lunch in the office because we had an enormous amount of copy to cover before the author came in at 3:00. As if sensing we were in a hurry, Stella sashayed into the office and noticed James eating a Hershey almond bar. "I thought you were on a diet. What's the matter? Are you tired of eggs and tuna fish? You know, eggs cause special acids and mucus in your system." "No, I didn't know that, but..." Stella cut him off. "Dave has a little yellow pill that clears it right up. No mucus problems for him. I made him go to the doctor. Dr. Bronstein, the one who says I'm the spitting image of Ruby Keeler. Bronstein says there's not a thing wrong with Dave, but he should take the pill for his drip. You should see a doctor about a diet. I had a friend who went to a special clinic for her weight. All she ate was grapes and watermelon. After 3 days, she felt much lighter." James rallied a smile. After all, you can't tell the boss's wife to bleep off. "I loathe watermelon, although I like them pickled." Stella shifted into second gear. "Mr. Cohen has to have his orange juice just fresh and everything just so. He won't sit down to the table if I put luncheon napkins next to his plate when he has breakfast. I have to keep 3 sizes of napkins around the house to please him. We bought new cereal bowls and he complained that I gave him too much cereal, so I had to pour the cereal in the old bowl, then pour it in the new bowl in front of him before he was satisfied. But coffee brings out the worst in him. He's pickier about coffee than he is about these manuscripts." "That's impossible," James asserted. "Ha! If you think he's hard as a boss, you should live with him." Stella, realizing what she had said, took a step back and peeped around the door to make certain no one had heard such blasphemy. As she inhaled for a refueling, we were saved by an ear-splitting shriek from behind the glass partition. Turds! My desk is full of turds. Every drawer has turds and yuck in it. From down at the end of the longest corridor in the office's dull grid structure, you could hear running feet. People swarmed out of their cubicles, which had pictures of Chiquita Banana on the wall. In the press by Rhea's desk, her photograph of Rhett Butler was rubbed off the wall. Stella blustered to the front of the mob. Rhea, what terrible language! What's the... Before she could finish, she was rendered speechless for the first time in her long life by the sight of all that carefully arranged dog droppings. The ruckus drew Mr. Cohen out of a conference, and he slammed the door behind him for full effect. The crowd parted for their patriarch like the Red Sea. What the hell is going on out here? Rhea, what's the matter with you? Rhea, her face bloated with rage, spat out, My desk is full of dog turds. David Cohen, with impeccable logic, answered in a calm, fatherly voice. But that's impossible. There are no dogs in this office. Stella nudged her husband's shoulder. Look in her desk, Dave. He briefly glanced toward the drawers, turned his head, and bent over for a second look. Then he said to his wife in a little voice, But that's impossible. Stella held her ground. Impossible or not, her desk is filled with dog droppings. This must be someone's idea of a joke, Dave concluded. Whoever did this should apologize to Rhea immediately and clean up this mess. Silence. Utter silence. Maybe it's one of the Puerto Ricans in the shipping room. It's absurd to think anyone in the front office would do such a thing. Armed with his new conclusion, fortified with the knowledge that men who don't wear coats and ties are capable of any crime, he turned on his heel and started for shipping. From the shipping room, we could hear excited voices in Spanish. David Cohen came back looking confused and angry. All right, back to work, people. This is a publishing house, not a circus. The janitor will clean up the mess.
Dance, Mr. Big, dance, dance, Mr. Big, dance.
That was The Deadly Nightshade. If anyone wants to call up and say who they think those last two pieces of fiction were written by, we will take that. There's a... Okay. Oops. The phone number is 371-5200, and if you can identify those works. I got upset reading them. I mean, I picked them up kind of at random from the... I was looking for things to read about women's work and women's jobs. And when I got to these pieces on office work, I was really struck by how the hostility between the women, and I think in all the pieces... Yeah, let me... Is that someone calling? I'll take it. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I thought the last one was Judy Pasternak.
I didn't write it, no.
Oh.
Sorry.
I thought the last one was.
Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye. No, it was not me. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Here?
Turn your radio down.
Hold on, can you put the radio down, Neil? Is it Doris Lessing?
Which one? Neither of them is, as it happens, but I'm curious about which one you thought was.
I thought both of them were Doris Lessing.
No.
No, okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, I will tell you who they were. The first piece, the one about... It was the second one I read, but it was the first one that I didn't identify the author. It was from The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. And the second one, I really thought people... Wait a minute, okay, I have calls. Let me see if somebody else knows that. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't know if it was mentioned yet, but the first thing you read, I think, was The Glass Bell Jar.
Yes, that was. Do you know what the second one was?
No, I don't. I wish I did.
Well, I'll tell you in a minute. I mean, I will if nobody else does. We have one more call, and I'm going to take that, and if they don't know it either, I'll tell.
Okay.
Okay?
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
Ruby Fruit General.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. It was.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, let me see. Yep. Hello? Yep. No. Okay, everybody hung up when they found out it had been identified. Yes, it was from Ruby Fruit Jungle. And I must say that that is the second time in that book that the heroine does that to somebody, does something like it to somebody. It was a reprise of something she had done as a child. And so it's, I guess I should say, that's Ruby Fruit Jungle by Rita Mae Brown. For those of you who don't know, it's just been recently reissued in paperback. And although there are certain quarrels that I have with it, it is a funny book, and I had a real hard time reading through that without giggling. I was censoring pieces of it, by the way. Some of those pauses you heard were me looking quick for another word, for the word for what was in Rhea's desk. Rita Mae did not censor herself when she wrote it. As I said, it distressed me. I tried to find other pieces to read that didn't have that kind of hostility between the women. And when I kept book after book that I picked up about office work had it, it started me thinking about my own life when I was in office work and realizing that for a lot of reasons, women are real competitive in offices. I think they're set up to be that way. And especially, I think that in all the passages I just read, the hostility was between older women who were successful and younger women who were trying to make it. And I when I was 21 and a clerk secretary typist myself, there was a lot of that kind of hostility. I don't know if it's different now. I don't know if the attempts to organize women in terms of feminism and in terms of unions both are making differences and keeping us less vulnerable, helping us be less vulnerable to that kind of competitiveness. As a matter of fact, I do know that on Women's Studies this month, Phyllis Sutherland is presenting a series of programs on women office workers. And Marge Albert, an organizer for District 65, was on her last program, and I listened to it, and she made a point of saying that when you try to organize a union in an office, you have to get past that. I wanted to play some more music about women working, but I've got a couple of calls here, and I would like to take them first. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I wanted to say, while I haven't had much experience as a feminist, I was really, cut to the heart. It, not only did I feel it like anti-sisterhood, but also anti-Semitic. Now, I know all different types exist, but like, for instance, in a play by George Bernard Shaw, I mean, you would get people acting as they act, but in the preface, always some kind of modifying reality would be presented. I really felt terribly hurt by this.
I was hurt by it, too. And I was also, yes, I was unhappy about the anti-Semitism, and Sheila Levine is dead and living in New York.
Okay, I just wanted to express it. I really just felt it in my heart.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you, when you were talking about finding books about women working, that I don't know if you're familiar with the feminist press, is about to publish a book called Women Working, Stories and Poems. And I was involved in the field testing of this book in a high school in New Jersey, and it was very successful. And they had some really fine selections about women working. The Butcher is a very good one, if you're familiar with that. I don't know.
No. Who wrote it? Do you know?
Oh, right now I can't remember because I don't have the book in front of me, but... I believe the book is going to be released in the fall of 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got some really good stuff by Marge Piercy, too, is another good one, like a short play about computers and things of that nature. That would be something you might...
I would be real interested in. I will make sure that I get a copy of it when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much for telling me about it.
Yes.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, back to women talking about their own work experiences, or in this case, singing about it.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore my corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow, smooth as silk, gives creamy milk. Learn to coo, learn to moo, that's what you do to be a lady now. When I went to school, I learned to write and how to read some history, geography, and home economy. And typing is a skill that every girl should need to while away the extra time until the time to breed. And then they had the nerve to say, what would you like to be? I says, I'm gonna be an engineer. No, you only need to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try and run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl. So I become a typist and a study on the fly, working out the day and night so I could qualify. And every time the boss come in, he pinched me on the thigh, says, I've never had an engineer. You owe it to the job to be a lady. It's the duty of the staff for to give the boss a whirl. The wages that you get are crummy, maybe, but it's all you get because you're a girl. She's smart for a woman. I wonder how she got that way. You get no choice, you get no voice. Just stay mum, pretend you're dumb. That's how you come to be a lady today. Then Jimmy come along and we set up a conjugation. We were busy every night with love and recreation. I spent the day at work so he could get his education, and now he's an engineer. He says, I know you'll always be a lady. It's the duty of my darling to love me all her life. I couldn't engineer, look after or obey me. Remember, dear, that you're my wife. Well, as soon as Jimmy got a job, I began again. Then happy at me turret lay the year or so. And then the morning that the twins were born, Jimmy says to them, kids, your mother was an engineer. You owe it to the kids to be a lady. Dainty as a dish rag, faithful as a chow. Stay at home, you got to mind the baby. Remember, you're a mother now. Well, every time I turn around, there's something else to do. It's cook a meal or mend a sock or sweep a floor or two. I listen in to Jimmy Young, it makes me want to spew. I was gonna be an engineer. Now I really wish that I could be a lady. I could do the lovely things that a lady's supposed to do. I wouldn't even mind if only they would pay me. And I could be a person too. What price for a woman? You can buy her for a ring of gold. To love and obey without any pay, you get a cook and a nurse, for better or worse. No, you don't need a purse when a lady is sold. But now that times are harder and the Jimmy's got the sack, I went down to Vickers, they were glad to have me back. But I'm a third-class citizen, my wages tell me that, and I'm a first-class engineer. The boss, he says, we pay you as a lady. You only got the job 'cause I can't afford a man. With you, I keep the profits high as maybe. You're just a cheaper pair of hands. You got one fault, and you're a woman. You're not worth equal pay. A bitch or a tart, you're nothing but hard. Shallow and vain, you got no brain. You even go down a drain like a lady today. I listen to me mother and I join a typing pool. I listen to me lover and I put him through his school. But if I listen to the boss, I'm just a bloody fool and an underpaid engineer. I've been a sucker ever since I was a baby. As a daughter, as a wife, as a mother and a dear. But I'll fight them as a woman, not a lady. Fight them as an engineer.
Hold the mail. Hot steaks and onions. Oh, yeah, hot Sunday.
Hot Sunday. You want to eat some kind of Sunday?
Ray and Hazel. And honey, and Lil, waited tables down at the Fat Boy Grill. 20 years of the same, they knew the roaches by name. Every grease spot was signed and framed, and the menu was small. It was written on the wall, but there was ham and eggs with toast and jam. And there was toast and ham with eggs and jam. The coffee was always hot, the china was hotter than not. They cracked the gum like a rifle shot. They had a neon light, they kept it on all night. When a hard-driving diesel cowboy rode up to the Fat Boy Saloon. He said, hello there, honeys. Honey said, how you do? How you gonna
institutions. Some people say that all things change, but our menus never do. So thanks for the tip, big spender. And now here's a tip for you. We got no,
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 no
chicken today. We got no,
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 no
chicken today. We got no,
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 no
chicken today.
For all my sisters who work in it, in an occupation that is rarely mentioned on this program or any other.
Yeah.
has been real nice today, bringing you other women's words as well as my own. I have enjoyed it. I want to remind you, if you didn't hear this at the beginning, the Women's Department is asking for contributions to send some reporters from here to Houston for the International Women's Year Conference in November. And if you want to help, you can send us a contribution in any amount, a check made out to WBAI, Pacifica WBAI Women's Department, and mail it to WBAI Women's Department, 359 East 62nd Street, New York, 10021. That's 359 East 62, New York, 10021. Help send this girl to Houston. Okay, I am Judy Pasternak, and I will be back next Tuesday at 4. Till then, have fun.
Watch the fish, oh, they're moving like quicksilver.